Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, thank you very much, everybody out there in Lay Radio Land. I was able to kill the bumper music right off the bat. I usually do an over-the-top introduction for my guest, but this man needs no need for this. He's a true, in my opinion, a true American hero in many different ways. I mean, I never thought in a million years I'd have the honor to talk to after seeing him on the History Channel. I'm bringing to you one of the most interesting people I've ever been able to meet in my life and doing these shows for years. I give you the one and only George Christie. Good afternoon, sir.
Well, that was quite an introduction. Good afternoon.
Pleasure to have you on the show.
I appreciate it.
For those people who may not have read the show notes, can we get a little bit about you, who you are and your background, please?
Well, for 40 years, I rode with the Hells Angels. 35 of those years, I was a leader and, you know, spokesman from time to time. You know, if I walked into the outlaw bike world in 1966, initially hanging out with were 1% clubs, the Question Marks, and then the Saint and Slaves, and ultimately I was introduced to some Hells Angels and Old Man John, who was the president of Los Angeles, kind of took me under his wing, and in the mid-70s, I officially became a member of the Los Angeles Hells Angels.
Wow. And again, I saw the show that you were on History Channel. I was absolutely fascinated with your experiences thereof, and I learned a great deal. One I learned most of all, I think, is the media likes to tell us one thing, in reality, is altogether different. Is that all because of the TV shows like Sons of Anarchy and the like?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. You know, there's been a love-hate relationship between the media and the Hells Angels, you know, since the 60s. And, you know, I learned after just being in the club a short period of time that the media is a very powerful medium. So, you know, in the past, a lot of the people in the club, they shied away from interviews or stating their position when allegations were made towards us. And I kind of went the opposite way. I started standing up for what I thought was right in the late 70s. First time we got busted in Los Angeles, I wasn't arrested, but several members were arrested. And, you know, since no one from the club had ever taken a position to, you know, disagree with anything that the cops put out to the media, you know, they said that it was a big heroin bust and, you know, there was no heroin involved. In fact, at that particular point in time, the Hells Angels had outlawed heroin, and if anybody got caught using heroin, they were automatically kicked out of the club. So, you know, that was my first experience, and that was in the late 70s. I went on a television and a radio talk show and explained the situation, and this one particular radio announcer actually called the police while I was on the air with him. And basically the whole thing unraveled live on the air with me arguing with this police officer about the allegations and what they had released to the media and what in actuality had really happened.
Wow. Yeah, I know there's a lot of misinformation about what role different groups play within the American drug culture. And it's my firm opinion that the largest drug dealer in America is, in fact, the American government.
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I know back in the late 70s, we had known some people involved in CIA-type operations. Because of my military background, I was a Marine, and then ultimately I went to work for the Department of Defense. And they basically were controlling a lot of that stuff. They were, you know, negotiating with it for weapons and undermining, you know, unfriendly governments, you know, to our political positions. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of substance in what you're saying. You know, a lot of people think that those are crazy allegations, but, if you get involved in that lifestyle, you'll find that it's not so crazy.
No, I used to believe it was all crazy stuff as well, sir. And then I came across the book Dark Lines by Gary Webb, where he lays out in detail and include court documents, all the stuff about around Canada, which turned my stomach, because growing up, how I grew up in Midwestern America, I never thought the American government would be involved with those type of people, other than perhaps shoot them or put them in prison. But to find out that, okay, we'll simply look the other way as you flood the American inner cities with poison and make a couple of bucks was indeed disheartening. But that's me.
Well, you know, there's so much money in the narcotics trade, and, you know, now the Mexican, these different cartels in Mexico, they kind of run everything. You know, the Colombians got pushed out of it for whatever reason. And, you know, there was a point in time where, you know, the outlaw bike people, and I'm not specifically citing any group, but there was a lot of people in the outlaw bike culture that knew how to cook drugs, and they were, you know, they were making drugs. But, you know, one of the things that I really drove home on the History Channel was that it was never done as an organization. A lot of people said, well, I was on 60 Minutes arguing with Mike Wallace. You know, the allegation was we were controlling the methamphetamine market as a club. And, you know, the club is not a criminal organization. The club has criminals in it. You know, so do the Senate and the House of Representatives. But most of these guys that were involved in the drug trade were very secretive about it. And, you know, you could be sitting across a room in a clubhouse from somebody and really not know what he had going. And that was because he didn't want to share the proceeds with anybody.
Absolutely. And then you had that rule, as I remember correctly, it stated that you had the rule that if you're involved in the trade, you'd be kicked out.
Well, it yes and no, you know, it, and, you know, sometimes different members, if they had power and they wanted, they were involved in something, they certainly didn't want to jeopardize their membership. But there are charters across the United States and the Hells Angels. If, you know, you get caught dabbling in drugs, you know, you get kicked out of the club.
Absolutely. Now, what I also found fascinating in the show and doing a little bit more reading, that unlike popular myth, would have us believe that all the different clubs are always at war, and all the members automatically going to kill every other member. That's not them. You played a huge part in bringing peace to some disputes, correct?
Well, you know, what's interesting, in 1986, I got arrested for a crime that, you know, never happened. And I wound up spending a year in federal prison. One of the things I found really interesting was the same people that we were harboring grudges with and in conflicts with on the street, you know, we were walking the prison yards with them. You know, we were, you know, getting along with them, exchanging hellos and becoming friends with some of them. And when I got out, I thought, you know, if we can get along with them in prison, we certainly, you know, prison's a very confined area. You know, my position was, if we can get along with them in this small confined area, you know, why can't we get along with them out here on the street? And, you know, I went on a quest, you know, negotiated with the banditos, the outlaws, the Mongols, the pagans a few times to, you know, put our differences aside. And, you know, I felt we'd be a much more powerful culture if we could all understand each other and get along with each other. But, you know, sometimes it worked, other times it unraveled.
Yeah, I hear that. I know I live outside of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. We have our own unique take on the conflict between the Hells Angels and Outlaws, because we got to see the war up close and personal for a number of years.
Right. And yeah. Was this, I'm trying to think, was that Spike running around and I don't know his real name. I just knew him as Spike.
Nor I know his real name. No, I'm unsure myself. You know, the time of the Outlaws placed a bomb on top of a car that was meant to kill a member of the Hells Angels, and the person that it killed was a 14-year-old paperboy.
Okay, that was up in Canada, wasn't it?
No, that was in Milwaukee.
That happened in Milwaukee. That happened up in Canada as well.
Oh, wow.
A young kid got hit by shrapnel. And, you know, there was a war up there between the Hells Angels and the Rock Machine. And it was very vicious and brutal. And, you know, very similar to the war down here we had with the Outlaws. You know, that war started back in the early 70s. And one of the interesting things I found was in the 80s, this is when I started petitioning the Outlaws to try to come to the table. There were people in our club and people in the Outlaws club that didn't even know why we were fighting. And, you know, initially the fight started over, you know, a jealousy in a woman. That's what the fight was initially about.
Right. Those fights go on throughout time. I mean, we had the old Trojan War.
Absolutely.
That started over a woman.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's same thing with the Mongols. Ultimately it was over, you know, claiming territory, but initially the first conflict, was over a woman that had been involved with the Hell's Angel, jumped ship, so to speak, and wound up with the Mongols, and they ran into each other, you know, by coincidence at an event. I happened to be there, and you know, a fight broke out, and you know, that was the first time we'd ever had a serious conflict with the Mongols, and that was 1977, I think. And, you know, from there it evolved into a full-scale war that, you know, still rages today.
That's incredible. I mean, that's incredible to see. I mean, that's something the media is very big on in promoting the wars. I think it's just all newspapers. The facts behind them are always interesting to know. Are you familiar with a book, You Gotta Be Dirty?
Well, actually, I haven't got to read it yet. I want to read it, but I do know about it.
Yeah,
it seems like it's getting some pretty good reviews.
Yeah, I had the author on the show myself, and I found his book to be fair and informative, and that's what I think we need more of, because, again, living in Racine, I live maybe 8 blocks from the Outlaw. They have a little house here, the Outlaw, a clubhouse. I live about 8-9 blocks away from it. And when I first moved to the scene, people said, you don't even walk by it because they can walk out the doors and shoot you. I know I don't want to walk in for any reason I can think of, but I'm thinking pretty safe if I walk in front of the door.
Well, you know, and I think the neighborhood's probably pretty safe as well. I know in Ventura, we moved into a particular area when we came from Los Angeles to start the charter in Ventura in 1978. We moved into a real rough industrial area on the west end of town. And, you know, first there was great apprehension with all the neighbors. And, you know, after 3 or 4 months, the crime rate had stopped. We ran out of all the criminals out of there. All the robberies and the gas thefts. There was a big trucking company near us, and people were going there stealing the fuel. You know, we stopped all of those things and made sure the local merchants weren't picked on by the, you know, we had to sit down with the local gangs. And, you know, they were happy to see us there. In fact, they embraced us, you know, up until my departure in 2011. And, you know, from time to time, there were even police officers that they had the position that they would just as soon let us handle the streets as them in that rough area down there. And, you know, we held court a lot of times, you know, with people impacting, you know, older women, families, robberies, that kind of stuff. And, you know, we handled it all in-house on the street there. And the merchants were happy, the public was happy, and the cops were happy, to be honest with you.
Well, I can absolutely believe that, because the police have better things to do if they can do those things. Yeah, absolutely. Now, let me ask you before I forget. I understand that you have a website where we can purchase your books and the like. Can you give us that website location, sir?
Yeah, it's georgechristy.com.
Outstanding.
And,
you're active on Twitter, too, correct?
I am Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. I you know, offer, you know, pictures, books, signed books and whatnot on my website. I also have a blog usually once a week. This particular weekend, I probably will put a new story up because I'm going to be at the Mob Museum in Las Vegas speaking and signing books.
Outstanding. Everybody who's anybody goes to the Mob Museum. I think it's great they're going to have you. I know my good friend Gary Jenkins that does Crimeline Wire will be speaking there, I think, this evening.
He's going to be there this evening?
Yes, sir. I understand he's going to be there this evening, yes. He's an interesting former policeman on the intelligence squad of the Kansas City Police Department, and his podcast, Crimeline Wire, is full of very interesting information. I highly recommend it, sir.
Right. Well, I will check that out as well. Now, what was the local mafia family around there?
I can't have them get be pronounced words. When I've had a stroke, I can't pronounce my own last name 4 times out of 5. I apologize because I don't want to board it. Yes, we have our own, but ours were shut down in the 80s. You know, you remember the movie Casino?
Well, I was just going to reference that. I was going to say, weren't a lot of that stuff happening right out of that area there?
Yes, sir.
The guys taking the
yes,
skin
sir.
And whatnot. Yeah.
Yes, sir. I mean, we had a family. After the FBI got done with it, wasn't much left of it. But more important, I think our most largest, in my opinion, criminals, let's put criminals in quotes, would be what's left of the outlaws, I think, if would be my go-to people for that kind of a thing.
You know, what's interesting is I went to Terminal Island Prison in 1986. I left a year later in 1987. I was fighting the case. And back in those days, they didn't have the detention center in downtown L.A., so you actually went to Terminal Island Prison. It was a medical facility as well as a prison. And I met a lot of alleged wise guys in there. You know, Michael Francesi, Salvador Gambino. There was a lot of the whole L.A. mob. Those guys had got caught with Carlos Marcello on bribing a judge. And so there was a big contingency of mob guys. And I got to meet them over the years. And it's funny. I got a funny story. I exchanged phone numbers with them. And I got raided in the early 90s. And when the cops came in there, and this will tell you how old it was, all my phone numbers were in a Rolodex. And some of your younger listeners might not know what a Rolodex is, but, you know, the roller that you put your telephone numbers in. And the cops came in there, and they saw all these numbers of these New York family guys and people in the Midwest and whatnot that I had met while, you know, I was incarcerated. And they released it to the newspapers, local newspapers did a story, and newspapers called me and said, well, you know, what are you doing with all these mob guys in your Rolodex? And I said, well, you know, I also had Sean Penn's and Mickey Rourke's number in my Rolodex. I said, but that doesn't make me an actor. And so they printed that in the newspapers, and it really, the cops didn't think it was funny. So, you know, there you go. Guilt by association, you know, and, you know, law enforcement, you know, there's a lot of guys out there in law enforcement. They go to work every day. They risk their lives. They do their job. And, you know, that's what it is. It's a job. And then you have a different set of individuals that it becomes more than a job for them. It becomes personal. And, you know, that's when I've found that investigations and indictments and whatnot get in trouble when the investigators make it personal with you. I had a big case here in 2001, 2002. They investigated me for 4 years. I got a 59 count state racketeering indictment. And there were so many ridiculous allegations on it that, you know, the indictment actually collapsed under its own weight. And, you know, I spent a year fighting the case. I I was in jail. My bail, I had to put up $2.4 million, which took me a year to put up. Soon as I made bail and they saw that I was really serious that I was going to fight this thing because it was just ridiculous, you know, they offered me time served. And I was using Tony Serra out of San Francisco, a great federal lawyer at the time. And, you know, he told me, he said, hey, look, man, you need to take the plea bargain. You're looking at 80 years if you get found guilty, and they're willing to offer you time served. So, you know, they dropped all the charges, but I pled to a tax count and a conspiracy count. And, you know, that was the end of their millions and millions of dollars that they had invested in, you know, trying to put me behind bars. So, you know, I'm sure that you probably have an audience that consists of some law enforcement personnel. And, I, you know, my advice to them is, you know, go out there, do your job. Don't make it personal, because that's when it seems to conflict the investigators.
I would agree. I know here in Racine, a local police department seems to have a problem at times with young African-American youth. I hope that we work beyond that, because, as you said, that is a job. It's a job that we have hopefully good people doing, but we need them to be professional as much as possible or do something else.
You know, let me give some advice to the listeners. If you're having a problem with a particular group of individual cops, it's not always the whole department. You may have a facet within the department that's pushing on people and doing things that are, you know, beyond the scope of an investigation and whatnot. What I did at one time is I hired my own private investigator and started investigating the police investigating me, put together a file, and I turned it into the police department. And, you know, there was no threats of going to the Justice Department or suing or anything like that. I just basically went in there and handed it over to them and said, hey, man, you guys need to do some policing here. Clean your own house. And, you know, the interesting thing was that they appreciated it. And they took care of it. They took these guys, those three or four officers, they took them off the street because they don't want any problems either. You know, the majority of these police officers are just going there trying to do their job. We live in strange times right now. And I think that hopefully, you know, we'll come to terms with these different factions that are, you know, butting heads with each other. And it's, you know, people from all facets of society, you know, we need to try to work together and put our differences behind us.
Yes, sir. I think without a doubt, communication is of primary importance now more than ever.
Yeah. You know, I found that negotiating with these other, outlaw bike clubs, always found some common ground with them. You know, you go and you sit down and you talk to them and, you know, respectfully voice your opinion and, you know, what your vision is and what you're trying to accomplish. And, you know, they basically have the same makeup as you. And you can always, always reach some sort of agreement that, you know, satisfies both of you and doesn't compromise anybody.
You know, so I don't think there's too many people out there that want to live a lifestyle that might at any one time end up getting them killed because they opened the car door.
You know, no, I mean, it's no fun. You know, I've had murder contracts on me. You know, you can look them up online where, you know, people came to Ventura and, you know, they had a map, pictures, map of my house, pictures of me, you know, guns equipped with silencers. And, you know, it was all because hurt feelings, you know, really wasn't about business. We lived in different areas geographically. And, you know, if I would have lived in the area they lived in, I probably would have been a member of their club. And if they would have lived in the area I live in on the West Coast, they probably would have been in my club.
True, sure enough. I can see that happening. And, yeah, I know that one of the more interesting things when you look at the outlaws, which I'm a little familiar with, as much as I should be, I'm sure, is how much that organization, members thereof that organization, I should say, were involved with drugs, of course, which means money, and guns, which means money, and therefore causes problems. You know, people want that money badly.
Right, right. Well, you know, money is a big motivation for, you know, most people. And, you know, it creates issues between people as well. You know, it's interesting. We've got all the drugs coming into our country from Mexico, and we've got all of our guns going back. You know, it's like a underground highway.
It is in lots of ways, and I think if we need, I think we can get handle on the one, we can snap the other. But God knows where to start on that one. I mean, that's a pretty big issue, but something we do need to be involved in, no doubt.
Well, no doubt. You know, certainly we need a lot of education. The war on drugs is not working. It's not going to work. As long as there's a demand, there's going to be a supply.
Yes, sir. What gets me is how the states of Colorado, Washington, et cetera, legalized it. Now those states are making billions in taxes, creating jobs like there's no tomorrow. People who have little old job skills are making decent money because they can do low end
right.
stuff for cannabis that pays them well. And to me, I'd rather give somebody a paycheck than a jail sentence.
Well, you know, my position is legalize it all, control it, and educate people on the downsides of some of the narcotics out there. I mean, there are some narcotics out there. Once they get a hold of you, it's very difficult to get out of their grasp. And, you know, what we need to do with those types of things is educate the people. And our prison system keeps multiplying and multiplying. You know, when I was in prison in the mid-80s, it was 50,000 people, I think. I'm just approximating in incarcerated. You know, now there's 2.5 million people incarcerated. It's just growing at an amazing rate because it's also big business.
Yes, it is, sir. Yes, it is. Absolutely. Another reason why perhaps we don't see drugs such as cannabis legalized is the wrong people lose money. But that's beside the point. I can get that soapbox all day. But I want to thank you very much, sir, for being on the show. Before we let you go, sir, can you give us the location of your website again, please?
GeorgeChristie.com. And check out my new book, Exile on Front Street.
Outstanding. Hopefully everybody goes to your webpage, and those people who have not bought your book, buy a copy, and buy a copy for the best friend. It's important.
All right, my friend. I appreciate it.
Thank you, sir. Again, sir, I really appreciate your time being on the show with me. I wish you only the best for the future.
Okay, my pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, sir. Yeah, follow. Great guy. Great, fine guest. I apologize. I only had a few minutes to talk to him today. He is a wonderful human being, in my opinion. I learned a lot from him. I learned from setting the show up, the few minutes we spent off air. The few minutes we talked, setting this thing up, it was a very, very reviewing experience. I'll learn more about things than I thought I ever would, and I appreciate him being part of the show. I want to thank everybody interested out there in the show. I really appreciate all my listeners out there. Remember, you can find me on Twitter at the Milwaukee Bob. You know, the website's themilwaukeebob at .info, and you can find me, again, at Twitter at the Milwaukee Bob. All right. That's all the time that we have today. With that, we wish you the very, very best. I'm very, very thankful that the wind did not knock me off the air. Anyway, have fun. Best of luck to everyone. Bye-bye.